Thank you. I'm working on Arendt's political philosophy, but this is the first time I actually talk about revolution in Arendt. I find her book on revolution an extremely difficult book, actually, as difficult as The Origins of Totalitarianism, which I have worked on more. But I think there is a similarity between these two books, if one thinks of her method. There is already a kind of received view or narrative about what Arendt is doing in On Revolution. It is often claimed that she favors the American Revolution to the disadvantage of the French. She thought that the French Revolution somehow failed where the American succeeded. The American didn't succeed in all aspects, but in the most crucial aspect, namely founding the foundational aspect of the revolution, like the second stage of the revolution. It's more successful in the American than in the French. So when I started, when I thought of this paper, I thought that there is a revolutionary moment on revolution in Arendt's thinking. But as I wrote it, I think that that's not true. I mean, there are several revolutionary moments there, because she doesn't only discuss these two revolutions. And I hope that will become clear as I talk. I want to say also that I'm not, she uses lots of historical examples. I'm not a historian, so I'm not going to talk so much about actual revolutions. I'm trying to rethink her narrative about revolution. And I think such narratives are crucial. I mean, it's crucial to rethink them, because I think narratives about revolution influence the way we understand what we're doing when we do revolution. I mean, when we take part in action. So one of the most strongly held convictions underlying Arendt's political thought is that Western political philosophers, from Plato and Aristotle to modern theorists like Jean-Jacques Rousseau or indeed Karl Marx, have missed the existential significance of political action. The capacity of debate and deliberation amongst diverse equals to generate meaning and endure human life with a meaning it otherwise lacks. Arendt takes this failure as a cue for her own reflections on the nature and significance of politics and the public realm. Performing a philosophical appreciation of the meaning of political action, however, requires that political theory recover certain key distinctions that have been lost or obscured by tradition or simply forgotten. It also requires rethinking such central political concepts as action, freedom, authority, and power. Concepts that, according to Arendt, have been defined in a largely instrumental and, according to her, anti-political way by a tradition hostile to human plurality and its unnecessary uncertainties. The human condition from 1958, between past and future from 61, and On Revolution from 63, books that constitute Arendt's legacy in political theory, are all devoted to this project of rethinking. Whereas the two first mines ancient Greek and Roman Christian philosophy in order to reveal what has been hidden by contemporary experience and inherited political categories, On Revolution is Arendt's most extensive consideration of modern political action and the nature of constitutional politics. The readings correspond in the sense that concepts and categories from the political ontology in the human condition and between past and future, such as action, freedom, and beginning, and the contested distinction between the social and the political, reappear in her narrative of modern revolution. But what kind of rethinking is at stake in On Revolution? Saïla Ben Habib has argued that there are two strains in Arendt's thought corresponding to two different historiographies. An Ursprungsphilosophie, or philosophy of origins, inspired by the phenomenologies of Edmund Husserl and Martin Heidegger, and a fragmentary history, inspired by Walter Benjamin. according to the first, memory is viewed as the mimetic recollection of the lost origins of phenomena as contained in some fundamental human experience. The second strain is the attempt to think through human history as sedimented in layers of language and concepts. Here, historiography is more like a history of concepts, but not exclusively, that identifies moments of rupture, displacement, and dislocation in human history. At those moments, language is the witness to profound transformations taking place in human life. Although there is a thin line between these two efforts, the aim of the fragmentary historian is less that of tracing and retrieving distorted authentic experiences than of identifying and articulating fragmented or forgotten meanings of terms and the alterations they bear witness to. The word totalitarianism, for example, signifies for Arendt a novel and complex phenomenon on the 20th century European political scene, a phenomenon that was not, however, itself political, according to her. To the contrary, it represents the systematic destruction of all she understands as political: civil rights, a public space protected by law, freedom of speech, and assembly among a plurality of citizens. As a phenomenon that transgressed the limits of Western ethics and politics, totalitarianism needed, therefore, a new narrative, a story that could reorient the mind and, as Benabib writes, reclaim the past. So one implication here is that Arendt's historiography is a moral and political task. Her theoretical work gives counsel, and this is an idea expressed by Benjamin in a short piece called The Storyteller. To give counsel, according to him, is less is less an answer to a question than a proposal concerning the continuation of a story which is just unfolding. In order to understand what Arendt is doing in On Revolution, her historiography of totalitarianism is as crucial as the political ontology in the human condition and between the past and the future. If historiography generally originates with the human desire to overcome oblivion and nothingness, as Arendt believes, her challenge in the origins of totalitarianism was to narrate a past that she did not want to preserve, let alone justify, but rather wished to destroy. Her solution was to resist chronology, which would have made what happened seem inevitable and even understandable or acceptable to some extent. Instead, her narrative breaks continuity and stresses historical dead ends and failures. Her narrative does justice to the memory of the dead by telling the story of history in terms of their failed hopes and efforts. But it also avoids having one's moral and political imagination stifled by arguments of historical necessity. This method of writing history in defiance of the traditional canons of historical narrative, as Benabib has argued, guides not only the origins of totalitarianism, but also Arendt's narrative in On Revolution. Contrary to liberal and Marxist interpretations of the French and American revolutions, Arendt argues that the significance of modern revolution is not to overcome poverty, the social question, which in her view was responsible for the failure of the French Revolution, or the establishment of limited government, typically seen as the great achievement of the American Revolution. What the modern revolutions demonstrated was rather how individuals acting together with a common purpose could create a new space of tangible freedom in the world, relying on nothing more than the power implicit in their own mutual promises and agreement. The revolutionary moment, if we stick to the singular here initially in the beginning, for Arendt is a moment in which revolutionary actors come together to constitute a new form of political freedom with new and durable laws and institutions. And this, I think, is still very important to her. It's not as if she abandons this idea. So this is a central idea in non-revolution. That the moment when revolution takes place is actually when there is this founding of a new political space, which has to have some permanency and therefore also new institutions. This mode of articulating what is revolutionary about modern revolutions owes its conceptual framework to the human condition. Freedom, as understood by Arendt, is a political category manifesting the human ability to establish the world anew, to reach out and attain, in deed, gesture, and word, realms, feelings, and thoughts up heretofore unimagined. As such, it can only unfold in a public realm defined by principles that enable humans to not only appear to one another and, like Achilles, be valued and remembered for their heroic deeds, but, like the citizens of the Athenian polis, act together and thus establish a genuinely human reality. Yet revolution, Arendt insists, exemplifies a characteristically modern political action and is evidence that something politically new can occur. So her work on revolution is somehow, I think, partly a self-critique. So she abandons, she's sometimes referred to as nostalgic, you know, as if she's just longing back to ancient Greek. But I think that on revolution, I mean, there is still this framework, but she's actually sort of admitting or recognizing that something new can happen in her own time. So in this paper, I will argue that the unresolved tension between philosophy of origins or Ursprungsphilosophie and fragmentary history, between tracing origins and authentic human experiences on the one hand and identifying unique historical moments of rupture and transformation through concepts on the other hand, is operative in Arendt's attempt to articulate a modern conception of freedom on revolution. Whereas Arendt's preference for the American revolutions make little sense without taking into account her ontological conceptual framework, her narrative method also suggests a historiography according to which the American and French revolutions function not primarily as examples of historical success or failure, but exactly as stories, each of which express specifically modern hopes of freedom. But why is Arendt turning to modern revolution in the first place? What is her counsel about? Or what is the unfolding story in response to which her narrative is a proposal? In order to answer that question, one needs again to turn to the origins of totalitarianism and to the epilogue of the second edition from 1958. This epilogue, which she withdrew from later editions, was an essay on the Hungarian Revolution against Soviet rule in 1956. Preceded by Nikita Khrushchev's de-Stalinization speech at the 20th Communist Party Congress in February 1956, and by the Polish workers' anti-communist protests in June the same year, the Hungarians overthrew the existing government in 12 days in October and commenced the foundation of a new government, which was then crushed by Soviet tanks. For Arendt, the Hungarian resistance contested her assumption in the origins of totalitarianism that the only clear expression of the modern age's problem up to date has been the horror of totalitarianism. Contrary to the nightmarish expression of totalitarianism, the Hungarian Revolution and the form of government it brought forth, the council system, expressed the promise of a meaningful modern form of politics. Arendt turns to the Hungarian example at the very end of On Revolution. Yet those pages are, I think, are the perhaps most significant moment of her book. As defeated forms of freedom, the 20th century councils at once motivate her to raise the question of the meaning of revolutions, of revolution, and are also redeemed in her own narrative of the meaning of politics. So now I will go more into the way she rethinks the meaning of the word revolution, and then also goes in more on how I will go into her interpretation of the French and the American revolutions. The fate of the word revolution is linked to the name of Copernicus, or Copernicus, English perhaps. His treatise from 1543 investigates the essentially repetitive motion of heavenly spheres. In his time, only the properly astronomical meaning of the term existed, and it was not until the French translation of Plutarch in 1559 that the revolutionary aspect of the celestial revolutions was being reflected, and the evolution of the term was set in motion. Revolution now indicated an abrupt transformation, although one which is still predetermined, signaled in advance by various heavenly signs. By the time of Kant, our modern term revolution is well established. The thought of Copernicus, Kant states in the second preface to the first critique, constitutes a sudden revolution in natural science, and I will not go into the political meaning of the term in Kant, since we already got such a great talk on that. Arendt draws attention to the original astronomical meaning of revolution, that is the regular lawful revolving motion, the regular lawful revolving motion of the stars beyond the influence of man, and hence irresistible. When we find the word for the first time as a political term in the 17th century, the metaphoric content was even closer to the original meaning of the word, she claims, since it was used for a movement of revolving back to some pre-established point, and the implication of swinging back into a preordained order. Politically, revolution originally meant restoration, and the revolutions of the 17th and 18th century, which to us appear to show evidence of a new spirit, were initially intended as restorations of an older order. They started as restorations or renovations, and the pathos of an entirely new beginning was born only in the course of the event itself. Even then, however, the early revolutionaries recognized signs, as it were, of the present, even in of the present event in the past. Thus, Robespierre could assert that the plan of the French Revolution was written large in the books of Machiavelli. The latter is characterized by Arendt as the Renaissance forerunner to modern revolution, and the first to think of the possibility of founding a lasting body politics, which becomes very important for her. Machiavelli did not use, according to her, the word revolution. He talked about mutations, alterations, and variations. The tension between restoration on the one hand and the founding of a new political order, however, recedes to the background in Arendt's own definition of modern revolution. And I have a quote. Only where change occurs in the sense of a new beginning, where violence is used to constitute an altogether different form of government, to bring about the formation of a new body politic, when the liberation from oppression aims at least at the constitution of freedom, can we speak about revolution? End of quote. In this passage, which is often cited from the opening chapter of On Revolution, Arendt insists on the novelty characteristic of modern revolutions. Revolutions are the only political events which confront us directly and inevitably with the problem of beginning, she writes, and must thus be distinguished from mere changes. They are bound up with the notion that the course of history suddenly begins anew and that an entirely new story is about to unfold. Her emphasis on new beginnings is a clear application or evocation of categories and distinctions established in the human condition. To act in its most general sense, she claims there, means to take an initiative, to begin, to set something in motion. It is the nature of the beginning, furthermore, that something new is started which cannot be expected from whatever may have happened before. The human condition, however, and the attempt to restore the memory of a political space must be understood in response to her work on totalitarianism. And I will just digress a little bit into that, the sort of core of that book, or aim. The essence of totalitarianism, according to the analysis in the origins of totalitarianism, is the total domination of beings by terror. The totalitarian world of unrestrained triumphant evil has outdistanced anything in the past, Arendt claims. It is not only the scale of the totalitarian crimes that are new. Mass deportation and mass killings in the Nazi and Stalinist camp system, but their character as well. The camps, which Arendt terms the central institutions of totalitarian regimes, manifest the final step in a gradual destruction of not only human dignity, but also the space that somehow upholds this dignity. The extirpation of human spontaneity and freedom. This experiment with human nature was preceded by the extinction of the juridical person first, when groups of people were deprived of citizenship and legal protection, and then by the destruction of the moral person, when the inmates were to make choices not only between criminal alternatives, but between ethically impossible alternatives. In place of recognizable human beings, the camps left ghastly marionettes with human faces. Not only individuals, but the human worlds to which they belonged, classes, communities, and peoples were destroyed too and thrown into holes of oblivion, as she writes. This is in the final chapter of The Origins of Totalitarianism. The human condition is an ontological reflection in response to the totalitarian destruction of these worlds and what Arendt considers to be a more fundamental modern forgetfulness of the meaning of politics. In On Revolution, Arendt recapitulates her interpretation of this political model, the model that she finds in the Greek city-state or polis. In order to understand the narrative of the French and American revolutions, it is helpful to have a closer look at what she says specifically about freedom in this, within the frame of her political ontology. The rise of the Greek city-states, she claims, was coeval with freedom as a political phenomenon. Freedom is here distinguished from liberation, as well as from the modern concept liberty, by which she understands civil rights. Whereas liberation and liberty may be a condition for freedom, she observes, freedom in the Greek context was understood as a form of political organization in which the citizens live together under conditions of no rule, without a division between rulers and ruled. Already then, such no rule or isonomy, meaning equality within the range of law, was accused of being ruled by the demos, or democracy, ruled by the majority, or the many. What Arendt stresses in this ancient model is that the Greek concept of equality did not refer to equality of conditions, even though the polis was open, of course, only to those who owned property and slaves. And this is, I'm not going into this discussion here, but I think it's very problematic that the two models that she seems to favor, the Greek and the American, is actually based on institutional slavery. So that's, I mean, that's some, that's the next chapter of the book. So equality in the Greek sense did not refer to equality of conditions, but to those who form a body of peers. Neither equality of, nor freedom was considered qualities of human nature, physis, but conventional and artificial attributes of the political community. Humans were not born equal and free, but received their equality and freedom by virtue of their citizenship, or by virtue of belonging to a political community. Being liberated, therefore, not being forced by others, did not necessarily mean being free or living in a political space, where one is neither ruled nor ruling over others. The reason that the Greeks insisted on the interconnection between freedom and equality, Arendt claims, is that freedom could only manifest itself through certain activities. Action, and more specifically, action in the form of or accompanied by speech. Such activities could appear and be real only when others saw, judged, and remembered them. A free life needed the presence of others. As Arendt's discussion of freedom in the context of revolutions shows, however, the modern question of freedom is more complicated. With the initial declaration of universal human rights, which took place at this time, freedom could no longer be separated from liberation. The difficulty with modern revolutions, from Arendt's perspective, is that they have been concerned with both liberation and freedom. Since in the modern context, liberation is indeed a condition for freedom, she writes. So here she has somehow changed her position a little bit. In the previous passage I quoted, she said that liberation may be a condition for freedom, but here she seems to say that it is actually a condition for freedom. It is difficult to say where the mere desire to be free from oppression and the desire for freedom as the political way of life begins. On the one hand, Arendt seems to want to keep the ancient distinction by claiming that desire to be free from oppression could have been fulfilled under monarchical government, although not under tyrannical or despotic governments, whereas the political way of life necessitated the formation of a new, or rather rediscovered, form of government, the constitution of a republic. Her more interesting and distinctly modern insight, however, in my view, is that it was the acts and deeds demanded by liberation that threw 18th century revolutionaries into public business, where intentionally, or more often unexpectedly, they began to constitute that space of appearances where freedom can unfold and become a visible reality. So what she suggests is somehow that the early modern revolutionaries would not have discovered this form of freedom unless they had engaged in liberation from oppression. more concretely through speech making and decision making, oratory and business, thinking and persuading, the early revolutionaries were driven to the logical conclusion of liberation, freedom in terms of independent government and a new body politic. Liberation from oppression brought to the fore the experience of being free in the ancient meaning of the word, of founding, actively engaging in and actually enjoying a new public space. To Arendt's regret, however, it was from the course of the French and not from the from the events in America that our present use of the words revolution, of the word revolution, received its contemporary connotations and overtones. It's a sad truth, according to her, that the French Revolution has made world history, while the American Revolution has remained an event of little more than local importance. And this is perhaps the more, here we approach the more controversial part of her narrative. I just want to ask, I started a bit late, so.
Yeah, you started like 5 minutes late.
So what is problematic about the French Revolution, according to Arendt, is that it turned the notion of historical necessity into a revolutionary category by seeing a multitude, the factual plurality of a nation or a people or a society, in the image of one supernatural body driven by one superhuman, irresistible general will. In this modern imaginary, the originally astronomic term revolution, the regular and irresistible motion of the stars, had, she thinks, had acquired the biological connotations that underlie organic and social theories of history. The reality corresponding to this modern imaginary of an irresistible, biologically driven generally will, she claims, is what since the 18th century has been called the social question, or the existence of poverty. It was under the rule of this necessity that the multitude rushed to the assistance of the French Revolution, inspired it, and drove it forward. As Arendt provocatively puts it, when the multitude of the poor appeared on the scene of politics, necessity appeared with them, and freedom had to be surrendered to the urgency of the life process itself. On this reading, it was necessity that unleashed the terror and sent the French Revolution to its doom. And I think this distinction is also something that comes from the origins of totalitarianism, where the opposition between necessity and freedom is constantly evoked. The conspiracy of necessity and poverty distracted the revolutionaries to miss the historical moment, and the revolution changed its direction rather than aiming at freedom and human rights, its goal of liberation had become the happiness of the people. Karl Marx, Arendt thinks, whom she also characterizes as the greatest thinker of revolutions we ever had, contributed to this modern narrative of revolutions because he was so much more interested in history than in politics. In her view, he neglected the original intentions of the revolutionaries, the American and the French, which was the foundation of freedom, and concentrated his attention on the seemingly objective course of revolutionary events. With Marx, in other words, revolution had come under the sway of the French Revolution in general and under the predominance of the social question in particular. So because most revolutions have concerned themselves with relieving the misery of the poor, the French and not the American Revolution was taken as a model. I want to add here that I don't agree with her on this, but I just try to, you know, follow her with her reasoning. Moreover, what revolutionized the spirit of men, she controversially argues, was not the American establishment of the new body politic, but America, the new continent, with its new man and the equality which the poor enjoyed with the rich. From the later stages of the French Revolution up to the revolutions of our time, she concludes, what seems crucial is the will to change the fabric of society, that is, social and economic conditions, rather than the structure of the political realm. And this had, she claims, had been changed, the social and political conditions had been changed in America before the revolution. Historians in particular have attacked Arendt's narrative of modern revolution. For example, Eric Hobsbawm writes in an early review of On Revolution that defining revolution as a wholesale political change in which political actors are conscious of introducing an entirely new epoch in human history, including, but only, as it were, incidentally, the abolition of poverty and aiming towards the emergence of freedom, allows Arendt to exclude all revolutions and revolutionary movements before 1776 from the discussion, though at the price of making a serious discussion of the actual phenomenon of revolution impossible. End of quote. Challenging Arendt's selective Eurocentering and misleading narrative of revolution, he concludes, insofar as Miss Arendt writes about history, her connection with it is as incidental as that of medieval theologians and astronomers. Both talked about planets, and both meant the same celestial bodies, but contact did not go much further. As more generous readers have pointed out, however, Arendt does find episodes of true political action in all of the major modern revolutions, taking the form of spontaneously arising councils and assemblies. In the French Revolution, it was the municipal communes and popular societies. In Russia in 1905 and 1917, it was the Soviets. In Germany in 1918 and 19, it was the Räte, which soon confederated into nationwide groupings to undertake the business of revolution and of governing. Such historical defenses, however, misses the point, since, as I claimed initially, Arendt is not primarily providing a study of actual revolutions, although she uses historical material. While she inverses the classic socialist understanding, claiming that the criteria of a real revolution is not social and economic transformation, but the more strictly political act of constituting principles that promote lasting public freedom through various forms of the council systems, her argument would appear, if not naive, so at least misleading if taken as a critical consideration of facts. As I also indicated at the beginning of the paper, the unifying thread of Arendt's political and philosophical analysis from the origins of totalitarianism to her reflections of the French and American revolutions is, in Ben Habib's word, the vocation of the theorist as storyteller. This vocation must be understood in direct connection to what she understands as a break in Western tradition, culminating in the 20th century totalitarian destructions. In her final words to the first volume of The Life of the Mind, for instance, Arendt articulates her work as a theorist as the dismantling of metaphysical and metaphysics and philosophy with all its categories as we have known them from the beginning in Greece until today. Such dismantling is possible, she continues, only on the assumption that the thread of tradition is broken and we shall not be able to renew it. What has broken is the Roman Trinity that for 1,000 years united religion, authority, and tradition. This loss of a past that seemed to be handed down from generation to generation leaves us with a fragmentary past, which lacks the certainty of evaluation. In order to understand ourselves and our contemporary world, however, it is still necessary to narrate the past. on the one of the leading themes of her ontology is that narrativity and storytelling is constitutive of identity, and that the narrative structure of identity corresponds to the narrativity of action. Actions live in the narratives of those who perform them and in the narratives of those who understand, interpret, and recall them. The continuing retelling of the past and its reintegration into the past, into the present, are ontological conditions of the kinds of beings we are. Arendt describes her methods as one working with fragments of a past, and quotes a passage from Shakespeare's The Tempest. This is a famous short passage. "Full fathom five thy father lies, of his bones are coron made. Those are pearls that were his eyes. Nothing of him that doth not fade, but doth suffer a sea change into something rich and strange." The storyteller is like a pearl diver who, after the storm, converts the memory of the dead into something rich and strange. Describing her dismantling in these terms strengthens the affinity between Arendt's method and that of Benjamin's. In an essay from 1968, she quotes the same lines when characterizing his method of citing a past that has lost its transmissibility. I'm running a little bit out of time, so I think I will try to end here. I had a short section on another step I think needs to be taken in order to understand her method, and that is like the connection also between her idea of the narrator or the storyteller and Benjamin's thesis on the history of philosophy. Sorry, philosophy of history. With which she was well familiar and even edited in 1968. I will not say much about those theses. I think you're all familiar with them. But I just want to end by suggesting that the structure of revolution, or I think that Benjamin's description of the historiography of the historic. Of the historical materialist in the thesis is animating or operative in the structure, methodological structure of On Revolution. And I think that the present or the Jetztzeit in Benjamin's terms, that is somehow the which arrests thought in his terms is the Hungarian Revolution. So it's the very end of the book that somehow is the most pregnant moment of the book. Until the Hungarian Revolution, Arendt had thought the tradition dead and irrelevant to contemporary events. What happened here was something that in which nobody no longer believed, neither the communists nor the anti-communists. The revolutionary spirit in Hungary, difficult as it is to imagine for us today in 2015, was evidence that modern political action and visions of public freedom was indeed possible. So the outbreak of the revolution in Hungary and its particular form of freedom, the council system, enabled Arendt to recognize political hope and action in previous modern contexts like the French and American revolutions. Thank you.